It's the story of an American held in a dark Venezuelan prison.
Then all of a sudden, they all kind of lined up. They pointed their guns at me. And this is the point where I thought, I'm going to die today.
I'm Becky Bruce. I spent a year working on Hope in Darkness, which now has more than 2 million downloads. Find it on KSLpodcast.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Healthy Mind Matters, where we discuss the important community issues of stronger mental health, emotional wellness, and the growing problem of addiction. Healthy Mind Matters is brought to you by Intermountain Healthcare and Select Health. Here's our host, Maria Chaleos, on KSL News Radio 102.7 FM and 1160 AM.
And thank you for joining us for Healthy Mind Matters. Today we're talking about death by suicide, and specifically the role of the medical examiner when someone has died by suicide. With me today is Michael Staley. He's the Suicide Prevention Research Coordinator at the Utah Office of the Medical Examiner. And Michael, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Kind of give us an overview. What is the role of the medical examiner once somebody has died by suicide?
Well, there's the traditional role, which is, we investigate that death. We determine the cause and manner of death for any unnatural or unattended death. And that involves us going to the place where the person has died. That's where our investigation begins. We then bring the decedent's body to the medical examiner's office, where we do an examination of the body. Then that's where the physician's work basically begins, and then they determined via toxicology and whatever tests they run the cause and manner of death. I think here in Utah, though, we have really expanded the role of the medical examiner, and that's why I'm here talking to you today, as I don't do any of those toxicological tests or that kind of thing. I'm a sociologist by training, and so why a sociologist and a medical examiner's office?
Yeah, explain for us.
Because when you think about suicidal behavior, it really breaks down into three different parts. You've got people who think about suicide, people who attempt suicide, and people who die by suicide. And those groups, of course, have some overlap, but not as much as many people would believe. And so if you look at the research out there and the surveillance even of suicidal behavior, most of that research looks at suicidal ideation and attempts, not necessarily suicide death. And so we need to know more when it comes to suicide prevention. We need to know more about the people who die by suicide. Many of them have never attempted, and we've never had any kind of interaction regarding suicide with, or mental health for that matter, with the people who have died by suicide. They're more likely to be men than they are women. And in increasing proportions, it's really a different group of people that died than the people who attempt or think about. Again, I don't want to overstate that. Mm-hmm. There's some overlap there. But there is some unique things about that group.
Are you able to determine, are men just more impulsive? I mean, you hear all the time, this is a permanent solution to a temporary problem. Is it that men react more quickly than women? Women tend to think things out more.
Well, it is true that men use firearms more often than women. And certainly that is a, highly lethal action. And so that could be part of it. Our research program is still very young, our research and surveillance program. And impulsivity is certainly something that we are looking at. But in terms of a proportion and giving you exact numbers, we're not quite ready to go there yet. But we hopefully, in the future, that's something we'll be able to discuss in more detail.
I find it surprising to know that the people that you have studied didn't have any sign, some of them didn't have any sign of mental health issues.
Yeah.
I would think this would have been somebody who was depressed or showed some sort of outward signs.
Well, there's two parts, I think, to that statement. Sometimes the person did have mental illness, symptoms of mental illness, but they simply weren't recognized as signs of mental illness. And, that's about increasing awareness of what those symptoms are. If my eye was drooping and my cheek was drooping and I told you I was smelling burnt toast, I think you would probably know what was happening and you would summon emergency care for me.
Certainly. Mm-hmm.
If I, you know, hadn't gotten out of bed in a few days or a few weeks, I stopped showering, maybe stopped going to work, you might say I was unmotivated. But would you attribute that to, you know, one of those cardinal signs of depression? And other times, people simply hide those symptoms and they're not there. And other people who become suicidal and take action on that on those suicidal thoughts may have never had mental illness. Maybe things got really bad for them in the minutes prior to their deciding to end their own life.
So as part of your research then, are you talking to families? Tell us exactly how that looks.
Sure. The research that we're doing really breaks down into two different parts, and one is not even research, it's surveillance. And so we, you know, every state tracks the method that individuals use to die by suicide, gender, race, that kind of thing, just these very basic topics. But there's so much more to know about everybody who dies by suicide, things like occupation, education, sexual orientation, gender identity, religion, whether or not religion was important to that person. I could keep armed service career, that kind of thing. I could keep going down that list. And so part one of the work that we're doing is for everybody who dies by suicide in our state, we're trying to collect better information about them so that we can direct the suicide prevention resources in the right places moving forward. The other part of the research that we do is psychological autopsy research. And that term is a packed term.
It is. Like, what is that?
Yeah.
Right?
And so we, with psychological autopsy research, look at specific groups who have died by suicide. And currently we're looking at youth ages 10 to 18 years old who have died between January 1st, 2016 and the end of 2018. And this is a lot more in-depth research. We collect numerous kinds of records about these young people who have died, including education, juvenile justice, child and family service, as much information as we possibly can about these young people that already exists. Part two of that research is that we turn to families and ask them these very in-depth, very lengthy interviews about the person that they lost.
Right.
And then we look, because if I ask you, Maria, you know, what is your favorite color? You might say red. But if I asked your best friends, they would might say, oh, it might have been orange or pink or something.
Interesting.
And so in psychological autopsy research, we ask multiple people the same kinds of questions because that person is no longer alive to speak for themselves. And so we validate those responses across many different people who knew them well.
Right. That makes a lot of sense, rather than probably a mother who knows certain things about the person, but not other things about the person.
That's exactly right.
How are families, friends receptive to this kind of questioning?
I've had very few people say no way, no thanks, and hang up the phone. That happens occasionally. But when I began this kind of work, I expected that to happen far more frequently than it actually does. For the most part, families really want these stories told. And there's so much shame and guilt and other negative emotion that's surrounding these losses that I've found that many families just haven't had the opportunity to really talk about the person that they lost in detail. And this is cathartic in a way for them to be able to come and talk about all of the different things that were happening in this person's life before they died, and even before, you know, the years before they died. It's really a welcome conversation for most of them. Some families, of course, aren't prepared to have these conversations, and you know, we're very cognizant of that.
It's tough.
It is. It's these are difficult interviews, even when they go extremely well. And so these families are often said, you know, I can't do it right now, but call me back next month or call me back in 2 months. I'll work with my therapist to get me to a point so that I can participate, because I really want my son or daughter's story told. And some people say, no, I can't do it, but maybe I'll find somebody who can. And we've talked to grandparents, aunts, uncles, step-parents, siblings, people who can answer the questions in a similar way to a parent or a guardian.
Right. You've talked about how individual the cases are, but is there a common thread somewhere?
That's what we're trying to find out. We are about a third to a half.
We always want an answer, right? Why did this happen?
I think that if I've learned anything for myself, it's that you have to be patient with these studies. You have to be patient with the people who we're talking to. We've rescheduled interviews upwards of 4 and 5 times, and that's okay. And it just takes good time. It takes a long time to get good information.
Mm-hmm. We need to take a break. I still have so many questions, and we'll be right back on Healthy Mind Matters.